Before Éamon de Valera became one of the most dominant and divisive figures in modern Irish history, he went by Eddie, a quiet boy raised in a labourer's cottage in rural County Limerick. Born in the USA, he was sent to Ireland at the age of 2.5 to live with his grandmother and a bachelor uncle. His mother stayed behind in New York, remarried, and rarely visited her son. The identity and whereabouts of his father was an enduring mystery, and one that haunted him. A recently published book looks at De Valera's life up until the founding of the Fianna Fáil Party in 1926 and examines how his character was shaped by these early experiences and a childhood marked by isolation. It's called Dangerous Ambition, The Making of Éamon de Valera. The author is Colm Kenny, who joins me now in studio. Colm, you're very welcome back to the History Show.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, we often talk about big historical forces, movements, wars, political tides as the things that shape a nation's history, that have shaped the world's history. But this work is about why individual character matters too, and how the personal story behind a public life can change the course of history as well. So let me start by asking, do you think Éamon de Valera is a case for revisiting the so-called great man theory of history, the idea that history is shaped by the actions of extraordinary individuals?
No doubt about it. I don't deny for a moment that general economic and social and political circumstances move our actions and inspire people to do particular things to a significant extent. But there's an interaction always, I think, between the individual and history. And Éamon de Valera is a vivid example of how a certain person at a certain time makes such a difference. I mean, he's down to this day, he's influencing us. Look at just last year, we had a double referendum, wording which was controversial, put in there to a constitution that's controversial, and people voted to keep it. And then we have this year, we're back with a government and the main political party, Fianna Fáil, founded by De Valera 100 years ago. He's still influencing us for better or for worse. This is a man who set the tone, not always for better either, but certainly made a difference.
Do you think anybody who knows anything about Irish history has an ambiguous attitude towards Éamon de Valera? Even if they are in favour of Éamon de Valera, is there still an ambiguity about him?
I've met people who aren't very ambiguous at all about
well,
him, I have
true,
to
yeah.
say. But it's true, I think, that people who look closely at him have tended to have a level of ambiguity, you know, kind of a Eamon Dunphy attitude towards him, that he was a game of two halves, you know, and perhaps he played the second half later in life better than he played aspects of the first half. A lot of people find it particularly difficult to understand why he didn't go to London with the treaty team in 1921, and then his behaviour in the run-up and during the Civil War, very, very difficult to comprehend. He was an pretty inexperienced politician, and he played a very dangerous game that backfired, I think, on him and on the country.
Now, you've looked closely at what De Valera read as a child, which I think is a very interesting approach, a window into the books and ideas that may have shaped his thinking in rural Limerick. One of those, for example, was a biography of Napoleon, which I found very, very, very interesting. And he admired Napoleon.
He admired Napoleon, and Napoleon has waxed and waned his reputation over a long period of time. And I noticed recently there was an interview with Jean Toulard, who's the possibly the leading authority on Napoleon in France at the moment. I just happened to catch it in Figaro recently. And he was quoting the Count de la Casas, who went with Napoleon to St. Helena and wrote down a lot of what Napoleon said. And this amused me because De Valera quoted something from the Count de la Casas about Napoleon saying that history was a fable. And he did that when he was invited to write the preface to Dorothy McCardle's great book on the Republic, which was very much a anti-treaty view of Irish history up to the 1930s. And his draft preface got censored or edited. So they took out the quotation of about Napoleon, I think because they were afraid people would think that he was getting ideas above his station in life. He had praised Napoleon when he was at college, Blackrock College, when he was a boy there in debates. And he had read a biography of him on the hillside minding cattle when he was being reared by his labourer uncle down in Brewery in rural County Limerick. So, yeah, he had read that book, and he hadn't, for instance, which I think is remarkable, or at least he didn't say he had. He didn't list Knocknagow, that great book about rural Ireland and the class differences in rural Ireland, which was written about a place in Tipperary very similar and close to Brewery. So he had an interesting choice of work. Most interesting, perhaps, in some ways, was his choice of Robinson Crusoe, a book he loved. And he had his little island, he said, in a stream in Bruree where he loved to play. And to my mind, the insularity of De Valera, you know, can be traced in some ways metaphorically to Crusoe on his island and Napoleon on his in the South Atlantic. There's something about that that catches the very character and essence of Eamon De Valera.
The loner.
The loner. The person who kept to himself. The man who was always known as the chief by nearly everybody, according to C.S. Andrews. Perhaps Harry Boland being an exception, but people didn't call him Eamon or Eddie or Mr. De Valera. He was the chief, so he had this distance.
I want to come back and talk about another book that you've discovered that he really revered, or he certainly enjoyed and certainly liked. But I want to talk about a book that was written about, not specifically him, but about the treaty negotiations, and that's Frank Pakenham's piece by Ordeal. When I was going to school, that was Holy Writ. This was the story about the Anglo-Irish treaty negotiations. You've revisited it, and you're not impressed anymore.
I would have agreed once that it was a great book, and it has had a remarkable shelf life. I mean, it's nearly 100 years since it was published now, and it's still been quoted as an authoritative text by historians. Pakenham was an admirer of De Valera, and he purports to be fair, but he relied very heavily on De Valera personally and on one of the British team during the treaty negotiations to paint a picture of the treaty negotiations that is ultimately a character assassination of Arthur Griffith and a vindication, if you like, of those who questioned the treaty and questioned it violently. There's talk of secret meetings and secret deals and documents that were waived that were supposedly assented to by Griffith. And the more I've looked at this, the less there is that stands it up. The book is not sourced well. It's not referenced well. He was given special access to documents through the good offices of De Valera, but doesn't say exactly what those documents were. And I found this document that supposedly was waived by Lord George in the House of Lords among the Lloyd George papers. It's not signed by Griffith at all. And when you look at later documentation that came to light after Pakenham was writing, including the diaries of the Cabinet Secretary Thomas Jones and the correspondences now published for the most part by the Royal Irish Academy in the series on documents of Irish foreign policy, there's actually evidence in there that will support Griffith's version that he gave to De Valera, that he refused to sign the documents and he was quite adamant he wasn't going to do any deal until everything was agreed. So it just doesn't stand up, that version of history. And I'm really surprised there hasn't been a comprehensive account of the treaty negotiations. It has been kind of dodged and it's mentioned in passing. And Pakenham is quoted as a source, and other secondary sources that themselves depend heavily on Pakenham are quoted. And when you go and look for, you know, where they got their information, it's only from Pakenham. Mm. So I'd love to see a full-scale revisiting of the actual treaty negotiations, fully referenced by a senior academic historian, because I think they'd find it very hard to stand up a lot of the Pakenham account.
I can hear your next project coming up just right there. Now, the other book that I want you to talk about, something I must say is a book I'd never come across, never heard of, Our Village by Mary Russell Mitford. Tell us about that book and the extent to which you think it influenced his thinking.
Oh, I think it's very, very fascinating that he identifies this as a book he read at school and he had a delight in, and he thought perhaps he might write a similar account, bucolic account of rural Limerick when he was a boy.
But this is set in Berkshire. This is not an Irish book.
It's the epitome of English settled countryside, you know, where they're out on haystacks enjoying themselves.
It's Agatha Christie without the murders.
That's a very good way to describe it. And he somehow thought that perhaps one day he would be able to do this. But then he decided he didn't have a close enough knowledge of the individuals in Bruree itself to attempt it. So it was a kind of a daydream of his. And I can't help wondering if his notion of the romantic notion he sometimes harboured of Ireland in the future and maidens dancing at the crossroads and that kind of life came from that work with which he was so closely associated as a child. And I'd never heard anybody mention it before until I came across his own references to it.
So this is where the Comely Maidens and the Dancing at the Crossroads comes from.
It's very possible that he was influenced by this, yeah, from, I mean, the peaceful English country life where that had been undisturbed for centuries was what inspired him to think of the future Ireland, you know.
It's a wonderful idea, whether it's true or not, but it is. It's an interesting conceit. Let's go back to the upbringing. You paint a picture of a boy raised in isolation, a loner, as we've already talked about, minding cattle, doing hard physical labour on behalf of his bachelor uncle. How much did that shape the man that he became, do you think?
Oh, very much. He couldn't wait to get out of brewery, despite some things that were written later about how he loved to go back there. And he pulled himself up by the bootstraps. It's a remarkable story. There can be very few people in Ireland of that time who managed to work their way up through national school, the Christian Brothers, into secondary school like Blackrock College, on to get a university degree from the National University of Ireland, as it now is, and then attended courses in Trinity, although he didn't actually sit examinations there in the end, but he registered at one point. It was a very hard effort he made to get ahead, helped by certain what they called exhibitions, what we would call scholarships that he managed to win. And a piece of good luck when his curate in Brewery, from the local Catholic curate, was on holidays in Lisdoonvarna and met the president of Blackrock College and was talking to him about this boy who was trying so hard to get ahead. And Blackrock was eager and talented young Irish Catholics. The French order had set it up and they wanted people like De Valera. And the president said, I tell you what, the scholarship he's getting or is likely to get will only pay for half the fees of Blackrock, but we'll let him come anyway. We'll take care of the other half. And he was thrilled. He never looked back. He could never understand boys being left off at school crying, or if they had to stay in Blackrock and couldn't go home for the holidays at Easter, they'd be crying, because he said to him it was paradise the moment he got there. It was an opportunity to give up the labouring, horrible jobs, like of really hard work he was doing down on the, as a labourer's nephew. He was being put to work for the uncle and for surrounding farmers, minding cattle, digging potatoes, and it was liberation to him to get to Blackrock College.
Now, one of, I suppose, his obsessions was his parentage, because there is an uncertainty about his parentage. What do we know about De Valera's father?
Pretty well nothing. There's no birth cert, no death cert, no marriage cert, no sign of him in the census of the United States. And we have a lot more information now coming on stream online from US records. And nothing has ever been found, despite vigorous searches, including by leading members of the Catholic Church in the United States, by historians, by three ambassadors to Spain who we pestered to try and find a family tree there. The sole record that refers to him, that's an official record, is a birth return from the hospital, from the Protestant institution in New York where he was born, where they return it to the state of New York, and the father, whose name is De Valero, by the way, on it, not De Valera, is described as Spanish. But beyond that, everything was just his mother's version of events, and that changed over time. And he never let it go. He was always upset by it, partly, it arose, first of all, because it was important that his US citizenship be established when, in 1916, he was arrested. And they did get a baptism cert. Now, the baptism cert, that's also, there's a question over that too. But the family in New York, his half-brother, because his mother subsequently got married in the United States, his half-brother and his mother and a few other people, were trying to get documentation to show that he was an American citizen. And his wife, Sinead, certainly believed that getting documentation in the United States helped to save him. But apart from that, he himself, you know, was anxious to prove his own background. And of course, on the doorstep, there were whispering campaigns about him being illegitimate. And in those days...
So it was a political liability as well as a personal liability.
There was a political liability. Mm. I mean, it didn't help in those days. Who knows to what extent? I mean, it shouldn't matter, of course, but it did matter. And indeed, some people wonder if his desire to become a priest, which he harboured for 10 years and revisited repeatedly, but never got much encouragement in it from anybody he spoke to. And he'd say this himself, that he was, you know, not greatly encouraged. And it's quite possible that was because it was an impediment in those days. And it could be an impediment to being allowed to become a priest if your parents weren't married.
Where did he acquire his taste for rugby? Was that before Blackrock or was it in Blackrock?
It was in Blackrock and he loved it and he was active in it there and in Rockwell for 10 years. And he used to go to the international. He was secretary of the Blackrock Rugby Club at one stage when he went back to live there. He was allowed to go back to live there for a couple of years after he graduated. Went to the internationals. He sometimes given gifts of tickets by his students, made very good friends with two men, the Ryan brothers, Jack and Mick Ryan, in from Tipperary, who were on one of the first Irish teams to win the Triple Crown. He just enjoyed it very much. And in fact, if you go for hunting for him in the newspapers, you don't come across, first of all, references to politics and him and De Valera. You come across Eddie De Valera playing rugby for Blackrock and Rockwell.
He also wanted to be a maths professor. Was that ever a possibility?
Well, that was his entire ambition, basically, professionally, until he was in his 30s. He'd no particular interest in politics, no more than any normal kind of Catholic nationalist child at the time would have a passing interest. He wanted to get ahead, but he was very disappointed in the he took his eye off the ball when he was trying to get his first university degree, and he only got a pass degree. And then he began this series of attendances at lectures and getting references from leading mathematicians whose lectures in UCD and Trinity he had attended. But he never actually sat the exams. He got a job then teaching mathematics to trainee teachers. And he decided this was enough to apply for jobs as professor in Galway and in Cork. And he made a great effort in Cork. He sprung into action with J.J. Horgan in Cork to get the Irish Parliamentary Party machine behind him down there, and managed to get a lot of support in the governing body of UCC. But he hadn't got the kind of qualifications compared to some of the other candidates. And when it got into the university and into the academic committees, they turned him down. And his interest in mathematics remained a hobby, if you like, I mean, to the end, and a serious hobby. And he set up, to his credit, the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies, and often went to lectures there too. And there are stories of him, even when his eyesight was very bad, having a big piece of linoleum on the desk in Aras Nuachtaráin when he was president, and chalk, and, you know, scribbling out physics formulae. And when you look at his notebooks in UCD in the archives, again, they're full of these scribbles of mathematical formulae. So he had some kind of gift for like of mathematics, but he couldn't organise it well enough in a way to get where he wanted. And once he wasn't made professor, that's when he took off in a different direction.
Yeah, because he didn't have a childhood interest in politics. He comes to politics quite late in life.
His uncle had a certain interest locally in land agitation, and he used to cut out these wonderful large colour cartoons that came with the Freeman's Journal in those days. I mean, they must have been quite impressive.
Weekly Freeman, yeah.
Yeah, and there was very little colour, of course, in the media in those days. And yeah, they were large scale, and his uncle could pull out these, sometimes stick them up on the walls. So, you know, he knew what was going on, and he heard talk about Pigott and the Parnell scandal and all of that, but he himself, that wasn't where he was going at that stage. He definitely wanted an academic life and a mathematical life, and not to least marries, really, does he start to really become actively engaged in the political process.
The marriage, how does he meet and marry Sinead?
He decides to learn Irish, I think largely professional reasons, because he knows it's going to be required more and more, especially with, you know, there was a campaign going on to have it as a requirement for teachers and so on in the new national university as it was emerging. So that, I suspect, was his principal motivation, first of all, because he hadn't shown much interest up to then. And when the census was held, the priests in Blackrock College put him down as speaking English only. But she's a mature woman, very interested in the Gaelic League and the Irish language, is teaching at extracurricular national schools, has done a little bit of acting in plays, knows Yeats, has acted with Douglas Hyde. Powerful, interesting woman, a very, very formidable woman who deserves more attention, actually. She hasn't really had the kind of biography that she deserves yet. And he's engrossed by her and starts to learn Irish. She teaches him Irish, and then he goes out, starts taking jobs in Irish colleges for the summer. And that's where it all begins, really.
Now, 1916, and the fact that he's not executed in 1916, and, you know, when I was growing up, we were always told it was because he was an American citizen. Since then, that has been more or less discredited. So where is the truth? Was the US citizenship thing, was that an ex post facto item to disguise the fact that he actually wasn't important enough to be executed in 1916?
You can't say with certainty what single factor influenced things, but I came across a letter in Blackrock College archives, very helpfully given access there, from Sinead to a very close family friend in 1917. And she's categorical that the American citizenship helped to save him.
Didn't save Tom Clark?
No, but I don't think it was organised. The campaign around De Valera was perhaps slightly better organised politically.
Well, they had more time as well.
It was a factor because, you know, the British were conscious of the efforts to involve the Americans. I would say that it was a factor and one among a number. I mean, his late arrest was another one that was fortunate, you know, that the steam was running out, if you like. They'd got their pound of flesh, the British. And then, as you say, the other story that was put out by certain elements in the British side that, you know, he didn't really matter. Mm. A combination of these factors, he was lucky. And so he emerges and he describes himself very soon after that when he's elected in Clare as a monument to the brave dead. This is De Valera, again, not so much the politician as the symbol. You know, a monument then, and in 1921 when he doesn't go to London, he calls himself a symbol of the Republic. This is very important because it ties into the whole notion of the king as head of state and the oath. You know, symbolism was immensely important to De Valera. He saw himself as embodying the dream of Ireland and carrying forward the dream of 1916. And to him, much more than partition, the status of the crown in Ireland was the thing that caused him great bitterness.
Mm, not partition.
Well, partition didn't matter a great deal. I mean, De Valera makes this astonishing speech. I think John Bowman was the first person in his book on De Valera and Ulster to really bring any attention to it because it doesn't get much attention. He stood up at one of the closed sessions. They had these private sessions, as you know, of Dáil Éireann. And in August 1921, a few months before they go to London to do the treaty, he makes this speech which causes consternation, where he said he's no objection to counties voting themselves out of an Irish Republic. I mean, just stop right there. That's De Valera saying counties can... I mean, how often do we hear that mentioned even? Mm. During the treaty debates itself, his famous or infamous document number 2 says pretty much the same thing, that people don't have to, they don't have to be. And someone has pointed out that there's only something like 9 of 300 pages of treaty debates in which
Michael Laffin, I think, has done a calculation that a tiny percentage of the debates was devoted to partition.
Now, in fairness, that's partly due because everybody thought that the Boundary Commission was going to bring in Tyrone and Fermanagh. And that's another story of how that went wrong. But the status of the Crown as head of state. And I mean, the British tried to say it was nothing. They yielded so much on it. It was only a formula, as is what Fianna Fáil ends up calling it. But I think that's disingenuous. I mean, it was very much mattered to Ireland to have a Protestant King of England as head of state. You were really rubbing people's noses in it. It was a way of kind of making people touch the forelock all over again, even as they got their independence.
You take the book as far as 1926, but obviously, Dev, few figures have cast such a long shadow on Irish history, and looking at where he came from, I think can only help us to understand him better. The book is called Dangerous Ambition, The Making of Éamon de Valera. It's published by Eastwood Books. The author is my guest, Colm Kenny. Colm, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.